Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to This Irish American Life. My name is Dr. Miriam Nighan Gray, and I'm coming to you today from Glucksman Ireland House at New York University. We come to you every week on WNYE 91.5 FM in the tri-state area and worldwide on www.nyuirish.net/radiohour, as well as on irishradio.com. We come to you every week in collaboration with Irish Radio Network USA, care of Mr. Adrian Flanley. For those of you who don't already know, Glucksman Ireland House is NYU's Centre for Irish and Irish American Studies. Inspired by the vision and philanthropy of Lewis L. Glucksman and Loretta Brennan Glucksman, Glucksman Ireland House, NYU, has evolved into a vibrant and world-renowned centre for the study of Ireland, Irish America, and the global Irish since its founding in 1993. We're coming to you today from our home, which is an elegant townhouse at Washington Mews and Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. Well, folks, here at Glucksman Ireland House, we inaugurated our fall 2019 calendar, our schedule of public events. We kicked off with a wonderful event by Dr. Stephen Butler, who actually is of this parish. He teaches here at New York University, and he discussed his recent book, Irish Writers in the Irish American Press, 1882 to 1964. I'm hoping to bring some audio of that event to you very soon. It was a great way to kick off our series, and we were delighted to collaborate with our friends and colleagues at the New York Irish History Roundtable for that event. On Monday night, our James Joyce Society meetings kick off. We have the pleasure of hosting the James Joyce Society, which is, I believe, the oldest James Joyce Society in the world, and they will be meeting here at 6 p.m. on Monday. The Argentine novelist and Joyce scholar Carla Scamero will lead this fall's Joyce Society meeting. And for more information on that, please check the joycesociety.org website. On Thursday next at 7 p.m, Gina Marie Guadagnino is going to speak about her debut novel, The Parting Glass, which was published earlier this year. I actually had Gina on the program there earlier in the year, and her great book, The Parting Glass, is a story that explores identity, social class, and sexuality in the Irish diaspora of New York in the 1830s. So that is on September the 26th, that's a Thursday, so please do find out more information about that on our website if you're interested. Now, this week, one of the things that has kept us busy has been the great announcement, we're very excited, that the President of Ireland, Michael D. Higgins, is going to come to campus on Tuesday, September 24th, so that's about 10 days. He's going to deliver an address. President Andrew Hamilton and Glucksman Ireland House are delighted to be welcoming President Michael D. Higgins to our campus. His address is entitled On Responding to the Interacting Crises of Our Times, Ecology, Economy and Society. If you'd like some more information about that, please do go to our website. It takes place at 6:15 in NYU's Kimmel Center in the Eisner and Lubin Auditorium. Because of the nature of the event, you do need to register in advance. And as I said, you can find out the information about that on our website. Michael D. is the 9th President of Ireland. He was elected to office originally in 2011 for a 7-year term. And in October 2018, he was re-elected to serve a second term of office. He actually secured the largest number of votes in Irish presidential election history. He's a passionate political voice, a poet and writer, academic and statesman, human rights advocate and champion of creativity within Irish society. He has previously served at every level of public life in Ireland, including as Ireland's First Minister for the Arts, Culture and the Gaeltacht. He is a fluent Irish speaker. As a lecturer in political science and sociology at the National University of Ireland, Galway, and in the United States, Michael D. Higgins was a passionate proponent for the extension of access to third level education beyond the walls of established universities. He was centrally involved in the development of extramural studies at National University of Ireland, Galway, and he travelled extensively across the west of Ireland to provide accessible evening classes for interested citizens. A desire to work more directly for equality and justice led Michael D. Higgins to enter public life, and he went on to serve as public representative at many levels, from councillor and mayor of Galway City to 9 years in the Shannon and 25 in Dáil-Éireann, the National Parliament. President Higgins is a writer and poet and has published 2 collections of essays and 4 collections of poetry. He is also a member of the Royal Irish Academy and the recipient of numerous awards and honorary fellowships. It's our great pleasure to be welcoming him to campus. He was here a few times before. He's spoken here in 2012 and 2015. So we're delighted that the fall of 2019 marks his return to speak on such an important theme and topic, and as I said, we're very excited to be getting ready for such an auspicious occasion as the visit of a President of Ireland. We're really, really, really delighted that during a busy time when he will be here for events at the United Nations, that he will be taking the time to come down here to Greenwich Village, down to NYU, and to engage with the community at NYU of Irish studies scholars and beyond. We expect wide interest and are seeing wide interest in his visit. He is someone who commands international attention, and we will hopefully share some of the audio of that address down the line. So, I had the pleasure last Sunday of attending a wonderful event. We were co-sponsoring Clyde Haberman and Pete Hamill in conversation. It was a fantastic event. Judy Greenspan and her team, who undertake the public programming for the Centre of Jewish History, did a wonderful job. The two of these great New Yorkers, great newspaper men, is just a pleasure to hear, and I'm delighted to have an opportunity to share with you the audio of Clyde Haberman and Pete Hamill in conversation, talking about all things New York, all things Jewish, all things Irish, and everything in between. So handing over to last Sunday's event, folks, for those of you who didn't have the pleasure to be there like I did. Enjoy.
Hi everyone, welcome. We're delighted to see all of you here this afternoon at the Center for Jewish History. I'm Judy Greenspan, the Director of Public Programs, and this is one program we have been waiting for all summer, Hamill and Haberman Stories of New York. So I'm going to speak for just a few minutes. I really would like to just get off the stage right now, but I have a few things to tell you, and then I'm going to get off. So first of all, on behalf of the Center and our partner organization, the American Jewish Historical Society, I just want to thank our co-sponsors for today's event, the American Irish Historical Society. Are they here someplace? The Irish American Writers and Artists. And Glucksman Ireland House, NYU. Excellent.
Great.
And from that group, a special thanks to Chris Cahill, Karen Daly, and Miriam Nyan, who were very, very helpful through this whole thing. And I would like to extend a very warm welcome to Emer Friel, the Deputy Consul General for the Consulate General of Ireland. Is she here? Wonderful. And to all the Hamill and Haberman family members, friends, and colleagues who are in the audience today. And especially, she actually is not here today, but I do want to acknowledge Pete Hamill's wife, Bukiko Hamill, who was just incredibly nice and helpful as we arranged all these details. So it is an honor and a tremendous personal pleasure to welcome Pete Hamill and Clyde Haberman to our stage today. Two scribes, a reporter recently wrote, an Irish bard and a Jewish bard that perhaps only New York City could have produced. So. Very New York reaction over there by Clyde. A little shrug. So, Pete and Clyde will share a variety of New York stories today. I will leave it to them to talk more about that only in New York quality they share. But certainly one point in common, by way of introduction, is that both are sons of immigrants, and their New York roots are intertwined with the city's broader immigrant story. So they grew up a few miles and a few years apart at a time when the Irish, the Jews, and the Italians made up about half of the city's population. Both came from the kind of tight-knit ethnic neighborhoods that characterized New York of their childhoods, Clyde from the Jewish Bronx and Upper Manhattan, and Pete from the predominantly Irish and Italian Brooklyn neighborhood that inspired so much of his writing. And the neighborhoods, the old country certainly loomed large, but the neighborhoods were also part of the bigger metropolis, where people from everywhere leave their mark on the city and quite often on each other. In the larger picture, much has been written about New York's Irish and Jews and the results of their fruitful collaborations in entertainment, education, labor unions, corned beef, apparently, and once upon a time in a Jewish restaurant on 2nd Avenue, green matzo balls on St. Patrick's Day. So, in his own life, 11-year-old Pete Hamill ventured beyond the world that he knew to help out a rabbi in a nearby synagogue, an experience that inspired his beautiful and nationally best-selling novel, Snow in August. So, covering the city they came from, Pete and Clyde first met in the mid-1960s at the New York Post, the tabloid that launched both of their careers. And as a daily journalist, Pete Hamill has written New York stories as they happen. As an award-winning author of both fiction and nonfiction, he has exhaustively researched and written about the city that was. Making history himself, he's the only person who ever served as editor-in-chief of both the New York Daily News and the New York Post. His legendary writing career took him far from home to Vietnam, Northern Ireland, Nicaragua, to name a few places. His byline has appeared in numerous publications. And as you can see in your programs, he is the recipient of a wide variety of awards, inducted into the Irish America Hall of Fame in 2016, named one of the 400 most influential New Yorkers in the past 400 years by the Museum of the City of New York in 2009, and in 2014, he was the recipient of the Eugene O'Neill Lifetime Achievement Award from the Irish American Writers and Artists. Pete is a jewel, folk singer Judy Collins said that evening when he won the award. The heart of New York City beats in his writing. So, after his time at the New York Post, Clyde Haberman went on to a 37-year career at the New York Times, where he was a reporter, bureau chief, and for 13 years, a foreign correspondent based in Tokyo, Rome, and then Jerusalem. Returning to the city, he began his popular column, NYC, and from 1995 to 2011, wrote some 1,500 stories about New York City, prompting one appreciative fan to post online, "I can't count the number of times I've asked a friend, did you read Clyde Haberman this morning?" So I would guess 1,500 times. So since 2014, Clyde has written a regular Times column accompanying Retro Report about major news stories of the past and their continuing resonance today. He, too, is the winner of many journalism awards, including a Pulitzer Prize, and in 2015, he was inducted into the New York Press Club's Hall of Fame. So here at the Center for Jewish History, where we collect and preserve the stories of history, and where a primary mission is to understand the past in order to make sense of the present, hosting this conversation between Pete and Clyde is exceptionally meaningful to us. So finally, just a few words about where we are, and I will hop off the stage. So the Center is a research institute. It's a place for public programs, concerts, exhibitions, personal genealogy quests, and all of this is because it is home to our 5 partner organizations and in their combined extraordinary archival collections. So I think it's safe to say that if you just entered here and came through the lobby and came here, you probably or may not know, if this is your first visit, what actually is in this building. There is actually a treasure trove of materials that go back 5,000 years and include millions of documents, hundreds of thousands of books, artworks, ritual objects, recordings, and film. So, this is just a glimpse of what that looks like. This is part of just one floor of one partner's archives, this one belonging to the American Jewish Historical Society. And not surprisingly, in this immense archive of Jewish history, there are touchstones for all of us. So relevant to our conversation today, New York's immigrant history is here. This is the crown jewel of the American Jewish Historical Collection. This is Emma Lazarus's new Colossus poem, which, of course, is on the pedestal of the Statue of Liberty. This is her notebook, her handwriting, and that is here in this building. So that's one piece of today's conversation, coming to America. Then, of course, when people got here, what did they bond over? Baseball? So here we have Sandy Koufax, but I realized that though this was, he started out meaning to be a Brooklyn Dodger, he actually didn't start playing till they moved to L.A., so this may be a bad memory for him. So I'm sorry. And I should mention that Clyde is a Yankees fan, but I don't have anything there. Sandy Koufax is Jersey. And then finally, just a little story in the archive that I wanted to share. Plenty of books about Irish and Jews in America, but this is a nice little story, this photograph. This is Sergeant Ralph Kelly serving gefilte fish to his Jewish buddies at a luncheon which followed the High Holy Days for Jewish servicemen. On the back of the photograph it says, "This was the first time that Sergeant Kelly had prepared this traditional Jewish dish, but it was delicious indeed." So, I like that. So the resources in this building are not meant to be hidden away. You can access things online, you can come here to our library. Anybody, no matter what background, should come here to do their genealogy. It's free. And there's plenty of information in the lobby that you can pick up on the way out. Also about an upcoming exhibit about Emma Lazarus. So after the conversation, we will have Q&A with Pete and Clyde. And there will be a reception and a book sale in the lobby afterwards. So at last, please join me in welcoming two friends, colleagues, and quintessential New Yorkers, the Irish Bard and the Jewish Bard, for what promises to be, as the Jewish Bard said earlier, a good schmooze. So, Pete Hamill and Clyde Hogan.
I have to confess, I've never heard the words Jewish and Bard put together. I'm Irish Bard all the time. Pete, let me begin the conversation by asking you something. As I was preparing for this, I came across a quote from the great and in some ways tragic Irish writer, Brendan Behan, who once described himself as a drinker with writing problems. That was true. He died at the ripe old age of 41 in 1964. He said, "Other people have a nationality. The Irish and the Jews have a psychosis." I'm not 100% sure, I confess, what he was saying there. But did he have a point given the histories of those two peoples?
Well, certainly in terms of the Jews.
Okay.
But also,
I'll own up to it.
In a different way, among the Irish, and there were variations of the sense of either oppression or the insistence on remembering how we got here. That in Ireland, particularly, my both parents came from Belfast. They were Catholics from Belfast, which means they were people to whom things had been done by a legal agreement. And they came here separately, they met here, but they both insisted that they would never do to anybody what had been done to them in the old country. And so they had friends who were Jewish and friends who were Polish and friends who were Italian. Thank God there was some Italian. We never really began to understand food until Mrs. Caputo came across the hall. and taught my mother how to make the sauce. But they were people to whom things had been done, just as many of today's immigrants feel the same way about something. And which our unity with them should not have to be repeated in statues anymore. We have one in the harbor, a French immigrant. But we don't have to turn our backs on people like that either. We should know we were once there, and we should never forget that.
In this context, I was going to raise this a bit later, but walking here from the number one train, I passed St. Francis Xavier Church, beautiful church, Catholic church across the street, and there's a big sign in front saying immigrants and refugees are welcome here. That's a sign that you don't see everywhere, obviously, these days. I'm wondering, to go back to the Jews and Irish, other groups too, perhaps, but certainly we'll focus on these two. Having this long sad history as being history's orphans very often, I was wondering if both peoples kind of play that a little bit too hard, perhaps? It's not as if Jews, certainly in this country, have not succeeded well. Irish have too. Is this a past that doesn't resonate as much today, perhaps, as it once did?
With the Irish, no. I think that worrying about Brexit and what's going to do to Belfast is a little obscure. Destroying a synagogue is not like that, with bullets, you know, killing, you know, bashing people with rocks because they're too Jewish or something, or with ice. That's an ominous warning, I think, to us, that we got to change this before it gets out of hand.
Mm. In Snow in August, your novel, in which you're there, certainly as this 11-year-old boy, you cite the gifts that you and all Americans, you said, received from the Jews, and you cite tenacity, irony, and moral intelligence. Now, I certainly have known Jews who lack irony, but don't the Irish, Italians, African Americans, various Latinos, and so on, share those traits? Tenacity, irony, moral intelligence? I'm not sure. Certainly, a fair number of people in my family can't claim any of those. I'm teasing a bit about that, but why is that a Jewish trait?
I think it's because it went beyond the immediate through great gifts for writing, where people would write about it and therefore spread it in papers like the Forwards and later in the mainstream papers. Hmm. That to try to define yourself by 10 people when there's a lot more in this town than 10 takes a gifted writers, and I think in my case so many good writers who understood the world as I did, I thought I did, Alfred Kazin and you know, many others. I have a list I've written. Having the gift for using words, I think it makes things penetrate the mind better than just blah, 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 standing on the corner. I have a book I'm reading right now that just came out, and I recommend it to everybody here. It's by a guy from Israel.
Yeah. Edgar Keret.
Edgar Keret. If you haven't heard about it, he's really got the gift. He has the gift for language. And I haven't read it all, but I think books and the papers that used to exist had a way of using language to make the new arrivals to New York understood, and the old understood to the old timers, and to make the old timers understood by the new arrivals. And I think all our newspapers, the tabloids and the Times, did their share, immense share, of trying to get that kind of work done. I have fear that it's going away, but
yeah, maybe not fully. But some ethnic newspapers did that too. I believe the Forward, the Forwards in Yiddish, saw itself as an assimilating force.
Yes. Yes.
For new arrivals, and does deal with language. It reminds me, you were talking about writers, Jewish writers who influenced you, and you had mentioned in the green room or whatever it's called before we got on stage, Isaac Bashevis Singer.
Yeah.
And I met him once or twice. I interviewed him. I was still at the New York Post. This is in the 1970s. And it was the 75th anniversary of the Forwards, and I was asked to do a piece about it, and I naturally went to interview him and asked the obvious question about the Yiddish language, is it dying? He said to me, well, I'll tell you that it is sick. About this, there's no question. But between being sick and dying is a very long way. And it's been proven true. I mean, the language may not be growing in a literary form as it once did, but it seems to refuse to die. Can I ask you, how you were talking about your parents as being open to various ethnic groups, that it was not going to, what happened to them, they were not going to inflict on others. Until you branched out as a boy to understand other groups, how insular did you have a sense ethnically was your upbringing? I for myself, had a yeshiva background for my first 8 years. We lived in the South Bronx, and then we lived in Inwood in Manhattan, which was largely Irish in those years.
Right.
And to us, the Irish were always the other. There was really no integration, as I understand the word. And then, soon after my 13th birthday, my bar mitzvah, we moved to the East Bronx, which was heavily Italian ethnically, with some Irish. And I'll never forget, being a fairly insular kid, that walking with a new friend, and frankly, after all these years, I can't remember anymore if he was Irish or Italian, but all I know is he was attacking the other guy. It was either the friggin' Mick or the friggin' Guinea. I can't remember which one. And it was like an epiphany, if a Jewish boy was allowed one, holy cow, they don't like each other. I mean, to me, this was a major discovery, that the world was a lot more complicated than I had realized. I mean, to me, there was us and there were Goyim. And that was the world. So suddenly I realized I had to learn nuance, even if it was only in terms of people not liking one another. Did you have any such epiphany?
No, not really, because where we lived on 7th Avenue and 11th and 12th Street, there was a newsstand, a news, they sold sodas and stuff in it too, sandwiches. They had a newsstand outside. It was integrated. It had the Forbits, it had the Nowy Swiat, which is in Polish, and they had the first Spanish language paper. All on the same newsstand with the Daily News, the Mirror, the everything. Not much of the Times, Clyde.
I'm afraid that's still true.
But a block away in each direction, there were two more newsstands. And they all had papers out. So there was an integrated sense of what was available. And then we were lucky because we were, you know, 2.5 blocks from the branch of the public library that's still there. That plus Prospect Park, which stayed the jewel of Brooklyn, the green heart of Brooklyn.
Well, what was your work as a Shabbos goy like? I mean, I always wish there would have been like a concept of a Sunday Jew, but I couldn't figure out what we would do. You're in a very elite group in many ways. I was looking around. I mean,
I might be the oldest Shabbos goy.
You might be. Colin Powell was too, and he's
healthier than me.
I looked up. So was Harry Truman at one point. Al Gore.
No kidding.
Barack Obama. Mario Cuomo, who has talked about it a lot. I actually talked about it with Governor Cuomo at one point. And probably best of all, get this, Elvis Presley.
That would make a book.
Absolutely. The Shabbos Goy, you know. You can go, but how does one even get a job like that? I mean, you just show up?
I was going by because I had to go to a school called Holy Name, where I was an altar boy, and I passed the back door of the synagogue, and just as in my book, a rabbi stepped out and said, please to help. I said, okay, and he took me inside and he made me turn on a light, because turning a light on was thought as a violation of
the Sabbath. Yeah.
Of the Sabbath. And I began to do that. I think there was a candle I had to light. And I got the enormous sum of 25 cents when I left. And that made sure that I was never going to pass by and say no. My allowance from my father was 10 cents.
And a career was made. How long did that last?
It was just the summer of 1946. Yeah. Not even the full summer. Because I then got my first newspaper job delivering the Brooklyn Eagle on 5th Street and 6th Street between 8th Avenue and Prospect Park West.
My first newspaper job was delivering the New York Post in the Bronx.
Really?
Yeah.
Kidding.
I did that for a year and a half. And it was painful. Getting people to pay was...
that's the Bronx.
Maybe you were better in Brooklyn. I don't know. But really, I would... come on, come back next week. You know, I don't have it now. And I was losing money on this.
Oh, geez.
Which I was to do again when I became a reporter. But Sick with Snow in August, a central figure, although he's not there as a presence, as a character, is Jackie Robinson and his integration of baseball. Now, I know there are folks in the audience who I know personally who know this story and are going to probably roll their eyes always telling that one again. And I know you know this, but one of my favorite lines involves when Walter O'Malley, and I know you're a great Dodger fan, when Walter O'Malley moved the Dodgers from Brooklyn to Los Angeles after the 1957 season, the running line always used to be, what do you do if you find yourself in a room with Hitler, Stalin, and Walter O'Malley and you've got a gun but only two bullets?
That's good.
And the Brooklyn answer was, you shoot O'Malley twice. Now, I've had plenty of conversations with you, and it seems to me that in true Irish and also Jewish tradition, you will forget everything before the end except the grudge. You still begrudge the Dodgers moving. It's 60-plus years. Is it time to get over it? Or maybe not. I don't know.
No.
What do you think? Time to forgive?
When it comes to Walter O'Malley, never forgive, never forget.
Okay.
Yeah. But if you mind, you mentioned of Robinson and how he made so many Americans conscious of race who didn't know. Because in our neighborhood, there was one black guy who lived. He worked in an apartment building on Bartell Pritchard Square.
Mm.
And I didn't know his name, and I didn't know who the hell Bartell and Pritchard were either at the time. But the first game I went to at Ebbets Field, there were like five of us. I was a kid. And it was taken up to the cheapest seats, the bleacher seats, which I think were 50 cents. And Robinson gets up against Pittsburgh. The first baseman is a player named Hank Greenberg. And the first pitch, Robinson gets hit. He goes down to first base, and we can see him. I'm looking, what is he? And Greenberg says something to him, and Robinson laughs. Then he steals second. You know. So years later, after I became a newspaper man, I interviewed Robinson, and I reminded him of the story. I said, what did Hank Greenberg say to you? He said, it's okay, kid. They pulled the same shit on me. You know. And they did, by the
way. And they did.
They didn't necessarily hit him every time with pitches before the war when he might break Babe Ruth's record. But they walked him a lot. Made sure he never got to 60. He got to 58.
Right. And then it took Roger Maris to get to 61, but that was an elongated season, so the questions were... Now, I confess that as a Cubs boy, my hero was Mickey Mantle, who was not the nicest fellow on earth. But I could still cite all his statistics, you know, and I remember once describing how in his year when he won the Triple Crown, which is a big deal in baseball, his batting average was .353, and Dan Barry at the time said to me, are you sure that wasn't his blood alcohol level? And it may have been. He was a prodigious drinker, but I don't want to overstate baseball. I mean, it is a great joy to me that all my children are indeed baseball fans, even if they root for the wrong team. But that's another matter. I've been struck. I don't know if you, because you've been involved with NYU. I mean, for me, baseball was a great unifier, as you suggest again in Snow in August and elsewhere, that it is. It was for you growing up. One of the things I've done in recent years is each spring I teach an honors course at Hunter College on New York City, and it's been wonderful to do. And at some point or another, baseball comes up. I probably tell that same O'Malley joke, and they're probably sick of hearing it too. I'm really struck. There are virtually no baseball fans among these young folks. Soccer, for sure, but I've practically reached a point. I think I'll do it again this coming spring, where if I find a single baseball fan, is a guaranteed A. I don't know what's happening in this regard. They too are heavily immigrants, or most children of immigrants. They tend to be heavily Asian and Latino, and a few Russians. But baseball does not seem to have the same attraction for them that it did when we were kids, as children of immigrants looking to be Americans. I don't know if it means anything, or if it says something. Any thoughts?
I don't know. I mean, yeah. My father really became an American when he got baseball.
Yeah.
When he got it, finally. And he could read about it in the papers, and he could see it on television when television came, finally, after the war. That's strange. They're not American football fans, are they?
No, they're soccer fans. They're the other football. What the world calls football, except us. They're soccer fans. One of the things I do love about baseball is it's almost a reflection of real life. Do you know any other endeavor where the best hitters, the absolute best, fail 2 out of 3 times? Do you know any other endeavor in human life where you can fail that often and be the best? I mean, it reminds me, Max Frankel, who's a good friend and is a former executive editor of the Times, tells a story about himself. He was the last so-called Sunday editor at the Times, when they had a person in charge of all the Sunday sections. And it has to do with success and failure. He tells a story on himself that he persuaded Russell Baker, who died earlier this year, to, in addition to his column for the Daily Newspaper, to do a weekly sort of back page column. And Russ Baker agreed to do it. And Max says, he said to him, "Now remember, I want the best of Baker." And Russ said, "Well, if you want the best of Baker, you're going to have to take the worst of Baker. Because it is just impossible to write a column several times a week, and each one is going to be a gem." I'm sure even you must have felt that at times, that not everyone was...
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's...
But I had the same feeling about the proportions that baseball gave you.
Yeah.
To me, it was 4 out of 10. You know, 6 out of 10 failures.
Wow.
Even Ted Williams hitting 400.
The last man to do that. City Column, we have a few former fellow tabloid writers here in the audience, including some of your relatives, including two
Dennis.
Of mine, including my dear friend Tony Mancini here. But it seems the City Columnist is an extinct species now. What happened? The Times only has once a week Jenia Belafonte in the Metropolitan section. I have no idea who else is sitting in the audience, so I may be offending some person who I still would like to publish me at the Times, to allow Jim Dwyer to suddenly not have his column to me qualifies as an urban crime. But others, I don't believe that the tabloids have columns the same as before. The Times' city coverage has certainly shrunken in general, as it's become more of a national and international paper. And I understand the imperative there.
What I would love to see happen, Clyde, is that they have a page in the city section and have a different column 5 days a week from each borough. One from Brooklyn, one from the Bronx, one...
By a different person, or...?
No, written by people working up there. There's some excellent writers working on the Brooklyn Eagle website, Laurie Krogan and some others. Get one of them. Get one from each of those boroughs, and at least give a sense of the local to it, which it doesn't have. Neither does sports. Sports writes less about the baseball teams than something that they think is the biggest story in the country, which sometimes is what people are interested in. But get the local in there.
It's difficult. I think if I were one of the editors today of the Times, he or she would say that's desirable, but the truth is the paper is read largely online today, not in print. And online means everybody from here to Saigon and back, Ho Chi Minh City, I'm sorry. But
reading online, you're making the choice yourself.
That is true.
So if you're not interested in the Yankees, you won't read about it. But if you're from here, you would have it. Why?
Your brief editorships at the two at the two major tabloids. To ask a basic New York question, what happened? I was still overseas when you had that wacky experience at the New York Post with Abe Hirschfeld and all that. I don't want to ask you to relive all that, because to have to relive being kissed by Abe Hirschfeld is more than anybody should have to endure.
I know that when I died, the obit will say Hamill, comma, kissed by Hirschfeld in 91 or whatever it was.
I was around to show you how well read Pete Hamill is. When he became editor of the Daily News in, I think, 96 this was, and I was about a year into my column, I wanted to do and did do a column on Pete. I'd interviewed him before his first day, and I show up at the Daily News building on his first day to just hang out there for a while, and he enters the building, and the security guard greets him and says, "Good morning, Mr. Hammond." Now, there are people who would have taken offense at that and gotten huffy. Not Mr. Hammond. He began recalling a writer for, I believe it was the Herald Tribune, many decades earlier, named Percy Hammond, and went on about him. There aren't too many people who was going to be able to conjure the ghost of Percy Hammond on the spot.
But one time on the subway, somebody said to me, "You're Jimmy Breslin, right?"
I hope you said yes.
I laughed. Yeah. Burst out laughing.
Subways. I remember once when I was still at the Post, and there was a guy sitting across from me on the subway, and he turns And I could see he's open to the page that I'm on. And he turns and he opens and he goes... And it's devastating. I mean...
It's what we call a great life.
Yeah, that is true too. That is true too. There was a terrific movie, a documentary on you and Jimmy Breslin that was done for HBO out earlier this year. And I saw a screening of it at the Time Warner Center. And it goes on at some length about your connection to Bobby Kennedy and that whole terrible June of 1968. I have to say, I hope I'm not telling a tale out of school. It is a tale out of school. I hope it's not too far out of bounds. I was sitting at that screening next to Kerry Kennedy, one of Bobby Kennedy's daughters, and she just couldn't bear to watch any of that point. At one point, the top of her body was at a 90-degree angle to the rest of her, just not being able to look at the screen. But I'm asking a journalism question here. Did you get too close?
Yes.
In that regard, and where does one draw the lines, especially when they keep erasing the sucker?
I think what you do is you try to understand the mistake that you've made first, which you have to first understand the mistake. And the mistake was becoming a personal friend to a man actively involved in politics. And after I understood that, I sort of made a little vow never to do that again. So that I admired, for example, Mario Cuomo. We never had a cup of coffee together. But Kennedy had reached out to us, too.
Us being you
being
and
me.
Jack Newfield.
He got... he really... Because he was from Boston, he really didn't know the local of New York, the local reality of New York. So he had Newfield take him to Bed-Stuy, where Newfield had grown up, because he could tell you what's there and what's beyond there. He asked Jimmy Breslin to do Queens. He said, okay, and he took him around, showed him Queens, and watched things. He took me to the part of Brooklyn I was from. And I knew from what he was doing that he might be different because he was listening. He listened. And then he asked questions based on what he had been asked by people in bars, people in the factory near my house, and he won me, and I wasn't going to do that again, because without declaring what I was doing anyway, and I'm still ambiguous about it, because it was so rare to know really decent public people that I will have that as the standard for what's left of my life.
It reminds me, there was a scene in a movie from the 1980s called Tucker, with Jeff Bridges playing this fellow Preston Tucker, who came up with a new kind of car that had all sorts of radical ideas, like seatbelts and other safety devices that took Detroit forever to incorporate. And there's a bit of a grifter who he's attached to, played by Martin Landau in the movie. And the grifter's past catches up with him, and he's about to be arrested, if I remember the movie right. But the line that always stays with me, and why I'm raising it in the context of you and Robert Kennedy, was clearly the Landau character saw Tucker as a visionary. But then he says that he violated a rule that his mother had told him. He says, "My mother always warned me never to get too close to people because you'll catch their dreams." And it's a wonderful line. And then he smiles and he says, "It turned out that years later I misheard her. What she said was, 'Don't get too close, you'll catch their germs.'" And he misheard it. And it's one of those wonderful, I mean, but I do like the idea of catching dreams, and clearly you did. But there were germs, too. And
my first great editor, Paul Sand, at the Post, when I was young, you know, crazy, trying to figure out what can be real, what can't. Is this true? Is this a phone call at the city desk? How do I know? And he said, "If you want it to be true, it usually isn't." And I think that's also an argument for skepticism, but not cynicism.
And my thanks again to our friends at the Center for Jewish History, and well done to Pete Hamill and Clyde Haberman for keeping us all enthralled during that event. And I'm sure you've enjoyed having an opportunity to listen to it here on This Irish American Life. We're coming towards the end of the program. I'm Dr. Miriam Nyhan-Gray, and I'd like to thank you for listening to This Irish American Life. I'll be back here next Saturday, same time, on WNYE 91.5 FM in the tri-state area and worldwide on www.nyuirish.net/radio hour, as well as on irishradio.com. We come to you every week in collaboration with Irish Radio Network USA, care of Mr. Adrian Flanley. If you'd like to hear this program again, please do go to our website on www.nyuirish.net/radio hour, as well as on irishradio.com. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch with me or my co-producer, Levon Henry, our email is ireland.house@nyu.edu. Just to remind you folks, we do have the visit of Michael D. Higgins, the 9th President of Ireland, on Tuesday, September 24th at 6:15 p.m. at NYU's Kimmel Center. And on the same week, Thursday, the 26th of September at 7 p.m. here at Luxman Ireland House, we'll be welcoming Gina Marie Guadagnino to speak about her debut novel, The Parting Glass. We're delighted to be involved in that event and look forward to seeing you. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Have a lovely weekend. Slán agus beannacht. The theme music today was the opening set by The Gloaming, produced by Brassland and Real World Records.